So the shir this morning, we're going to do Le'iloi Nishmat Dr. Goldstein, Devorah's father, and Chani's father, who I know for many years. Dr. Goldstein had, or Rabbi Goldstein, had many, many zuchuyot. Among the things which, I don't know how much they talk about, but he was the personal physician for Rabbi Soloveitchik. And there are many, 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 many stories about this, so... What we're going to do today is, I am not going, as far as I can tell, I'm going to try to avoid saying anything original today. I hope you don't care one way or the other. But what I am going to do is to teach something which Rabbi Soloveitchik was very fond of. And one of the reasons he was very fond of it was because it was something which is based upon his great-grandfather, the Beit Halevi's writings. Every now and again... See, when Rabbi Soloveitchik spoke, more often than not, he didn't bring sources. And it wasn't because he didn't know the sources, but it also sometimes depended on the audience. So a number of the chumashirim that he gave were to generally, quote-unquote, lower level in terms of knowledge. So he didn't always quote chapter and verse, but he really was quite fond of the Beit Halevi, of the Nitziv, who were both ancestors. And... what we're going to try to do is to put together something which he had said, and that's enough of an introduction. Okay, there is a challenge in Parshat Mishpatim, and being that last week we missed Parshat Yitro, so therefore I'm going to try to put the two of them together. So here's the first challenge, and I hope that when I make reference to various chapter numbers that you will have some familiarity with them. So just in case you don't, so we will quickly delineate. You have, last week we had Perek Yudchet, which does not concern us today. That's when Yitro arrives. Perek Yudtet, which is the preparation for Har Sinai. Perek Kaf, which is Ma'amad Har Sinai, which includes the Ten Commandments. And then you have a couple of verses afterwards, which may be quite important. And then that leads into Perek Kaf Aleph, which is where Parshat Mishpatim begins. Parshat Mishpatim, you have three chapters, Kaf Aleph, Kaf Bet, Kaf Gimel, dealing with laws, starting with more personal laws, then going to some other types of laws as well. And then Perek Kaf Dalet comes back to things regarding about getting ready for receiving the Torah. So the basic question that comes up, and this we will not do, this is your homework if you choose to do it, that is the argument which exists between Rashi and the Ramban. According to Rashi, there is no such thing in the Chumash as a default assumption of chronological integrity, which means in simple... Isn't that easier in Hebrew to say it? Right? So now you know you made it when a term is easier in Hebrew than it is English. In Hebrew we know that as Ein Mukdam U'Mukhar LaTorah. According to Rashi, there is no given assumption that things follow a specific sequence, even though you say, but of course it follows a sequence. Yes, it follows a sequence, unless it doesn't follow a sequence. So therefore, if I will go to the chapter that I said I was going to skip, and that was chapter 18, Perek Yudchet, according to Rashi, Perek Yudchet takes place, it says, Vayimi Mocharat. Rashi says Macharat is the day after Yom Kippur. If you look in Perek Lamed Hei, Vayakel Moshe, Moshe says it's the day after, Rashi says the day after Yom Kippur. So as far as Rashi is concerned, Perek Yudchet and Perek Lamed Hei happen the same day. That is an example of Ein Mukdam Mukhar, or, as we prefer to call it, that there is no assumption of chronological integrity. On the other hand, the Ramban will say there is absolutely Yesh Mukdam Mukhar, there is absolutely chronological integrity, unless there is a 100% clear textual reference which gives you no choice. Which means the Ramban is not going to say that everything in the Chumash has to follow the proper chronological sequence. He says that's the default unless you have overwhelming evidence which cannot be argued another way. For example, in the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar, you're going to have a date which is given in the second year, in the second month, and then a couple of chapters later, you're going to find that we are in the second year in the first month. The Ramban is not going to go and try to explain to you that it really is in order. He'll give in examples like that. The places he won't give in is where there is no absolute evidence which cannot be read in another way. Now, generally when we start to think about the issue of things following proper sequence or not, we generally focus around the problem or the question of the Chet HaEgel. Because it could be that that's the most stunning example in terms of Sefer Shemot, whereby Rashi will tell us, and he says so clearly, that the Cheta Egel happened, in fact, before the instruction to build the Mishkan, which essentially will say that by the time we're going to finish Parshat Mishpatim, you need to stick in someplace over here the Cheta Egel, which again happens later, because next week already we start with the Mishkan. So someplace between Perakuf Dal and Perakuf Hey is where the Cheta Egel actually takes place. And then as a response to this is why we have the instructions to build the Mishkan, which then creates its own very interesting theological discussions. The Ramban will argue the other way around, and that is that no, there is integrity, which means that first the instructions were given, which means I'll make it very clear. Maybe we'll talk about this more next week, but I'll make it very clear. When Moshe goes up to heaven, what is it that's discussed? According to the Ramban, the thing which is discussed is building the Mishkan. So therefore, building the Mishkan, that's all discussed, that's all in order, and then Moshe, just like the order of the text, and then at the end of all these instructions, then Moshe comes down, and lo and behold, they're making an egel. So according to the Rambam, things follow. Now that, as I said, is the most striking example of Ein Mukdam B'Mochar or Yesh Mukdam B'Mochar. But there's another example, which, as I said, I'm going to leave it to you to work out on your own if you so choose, or if you give up, you can go looking online someplace when I've spoken about this in the past. And that is that what do we do with Perek Yud Tet and Perek Kaf Dalet? Which means we have Perek Yud Tet, preparation for Har Sinai. We have the Aseret HaDibrot Perek Kaf. Then Kaf Aleph, Kaf Bet, Kaf Gimel. How do those fit into all this? And then Kaf Dalet, where Moshe is actually going to go up. So according to Rashi, what's going to be the simple explanation? The simple explanation will once again be that we have no chronological integrity, meaning that Perek Yud Tet and Perek Kaf Dalet happen at the same time, according to Rashi. Yeah, I'll give you the biggest issue. The biggest issue is Naaseh V'Nishma. Where does it actually say Naaseh V'Nishma? It says it in this week's parasha in Perek Kaf Dalet. I don't know if you've noticed this, but it's after last week's parasha. What was in last week's parasha? The Aseret HaDibrot. So therefore, wouldn't Naaseh V'Nishma be more impressive if they said it before they heard the Aseret HaDibrot as opposed to after? So now you understand what's at stake for Rashi. Aside from the fact that Rashi is working with various Gemarot and various Midrashim, if I say that the text follows the chronology, and I can't make exceptions whenever I feel like it, then the people said Naaseh V'Nishma, not just after they heard specifically the Aseret HaDibrot, after they heard a lot of other material as well. And by the way, who's going to end up saying that? Because I won't say he has no choice, but he chooses to look at it that way. Who's going to end up saying that? The Ramban. Because the Ramban says, no, things follow their proper order. So therefore, the Ramban is willing to sacrifice Naaseh V'Nishma because things follow their proper order. So they said Naaseh V'Nishma after they heard a whole lot. According to the Ramban, then what's the purpose of Naaseh V'Nishma? Why does it help me at all? According to the Ramban, the Naaseh V'Nishma is something completely different. It wasn't this unbelievable thing like the Gemara makes it sound. Naaseh V'Nishma is something else. Naaseh V'Nishma is actually, as far as the Ramban is concerned, it is Ma'amad Har Sinai, revelation at Sinai for the Ramban, is an experience of conversion. It's when the entire Jewish people become converted and become Jews. In order to convert and become Jews, one of the things that you need is Kabbalat HaMitzvot. I need to accept upon the Mitzvot. Do you accept the Mitzvot before you know what the Mitzvot are? Or do you only accept the Mitzvot after you know what the Mitzvot are? By the way, just think for a second. If the Jews can say Naaseh V'Nishma, so what's everybody's big problem with conversion today? Just say Naaseh V'Nishma. Okay, I accept. Why do I have to teach them anything? Why do I have to start checking everything? And now, so I'm saying, realize the implications of what Rashi is saying. Rashi, again, is taking chapter 24, Perakot Dalet, sticking it back before, in the middle, again, if you follow the Rashis in Yutet and in Kaf Dalet, you'll notice you have to chart it, because then you'll see what happened on the first day, on the second day, on the third day, the fourth day, the 15th, the sixth day of Sivan, and he has it all worked out, but completely divided between these two chapters, and you need to read them layered, one on top of the other, so then to try to re-understand what these events were, what was not just the chronology, but what was the substance of what happened on each day. Because according to Rashi, they're divided in those two different places. According to the Ramban, they go in the proper order. If they're in the proper order, then Nasa V'Nishma is after Mamad Har Sinai, not just after Mamad Sinai. What else is it after? It's after hearing Mishpatim. It's after hearing three chapters of Mishpatim. Which means they know a great deal of law by the time they say Nasa V'Nishma. So Nasa V'Nishma got ruined, but their conversion is more impressive because they accepted more upon themselves. If you now understand what's going on. As I said, all that is not of interest to me today, and that's what we're skipping. But that, as I said, is your homework if you choose to think about that, but it's not as difficult as you think actually to line them up. At least I don't think it is. But we're going to follow Rashi. We're going to follow Rashi's perspective. And we're going to start with what is, in my mind, the most striking verse, which is maybe difficult to say that because we're ignoring Nasa V'Nishma, but it's what God invites Moshe up to get. So this is source number one. V'yomar Hashem el Moshe, Alei Elai Hahara, come up to me in the mountain, V'hayesham, and be there. V'nelach, I'm going to give you at Luchora Evan. So now pay attention what Moshe is being offered. I'm going to give you the tablets of stone. V'hatorah, I'm going to give you additionally Torah, whatever the word Torah means. In its most technical sense, what does Torah mean? It means instructions. In its generic sense, how do we understand it? It means what we call, right. And in its specific sense, it means what we call Torah, and we imagine a scroll and whatever. Luchot ha'evin v'ha'torah v'ha'mitzvah. So what exactly is that? And how is that different from the Torah and the Luchot ha'evin? Asher katafti, which I've written, lahorotam, to instruct them thereof. Now, do we all realize there's a lot of words in that verse? And what he's inviting them up to is, come, this is what's going to happen, which means the reason why I find this so intriguing is because more so than Nasa V'Nishma, because we don't know really what they're referring to, over here we have God inviting Moshe up and telling him, this is what I'm going to give you. This is what's going to happen at Sinai. Now, I do want to warn you that we sometimes confuse ourselves because we confuse two different terms which sound so similar. One is a concept which is called Torah Misinai, what Moshe gets at Sinai, and the other is something which is called Torah min hashamayim, Torah being divine. So, may even sounded the same, right? Torah mi Sinai and Torah min hashamayim sound very, very similar, but are they necessarily similar? So, what I'm getting at with this is, when Moshe gets the Torah, what did this verse just now imply? Or you're not sure what it implies? Which means an awful lot. Which means an awful lot of everything. That's what it implies. Which therefore it implies that all of Torah is Misinai. Now, of course, so what I'm asking then is, what if, for example, I were to say, I don't necessarily believe, and of course I'll be attacked for saying this, I don't necessarily believe that all of Torah is Misinai, but I do believe that all of Torah is Min HaShemayim. Which means, which one is an article of faith? I'll give you an extreme example, which the Gemara talks about. Extreme example is, who wrote the last eight verses of the Torah? So the last eight verses of the Torah, the Gemara says, and by the way, the Mishnah Berurah actually rules this way. Nobody knows this because nobody knows to look. He actually rules this way. He says, no, this is the accepted, which is funny because it's a philosophical opinion. The Rambam seems to go the other way, but rules that Yehoshua wrote the last eight verses. If Yeshua wrote the last eight verses, that means it's not Torah Misinai. By the way, it's not even Torah Moshe as such. But on what basis did Yeshua write it? Right? Was Yeshua like sitting out there in the desert, had a cup of coffee in one hand, a cigarette in the other hand, and he's saying, well, you know, we need a good ending of this book, and no. But rather, what is it? And based on what did Yeshua write this? Torah Min HaShemayim. That God speaks to him as a prophet and tells him word for word, letter for letter, what to write. Which means I can believe that the entire Torah is Torah min HaShemayim, even though I may not necessarily believe that the entire Torah is Torah Misinai. Right? So I'm just saying to really understand the difference over here. And the Gemara not only entertains, the Gemara thinks that's a pretty logical position to take, that not necessarily everything is Misinai, but everything is Min HaShemayim. Which means, it's true that if somebody were to say, I believe that Moshe wrote a pasuk based on himself, God never gave him authority to write that pasuk, that would be considered heresy, at least according to the Rambam. Why? Because he says, Moshe lefnei atzmo, Moshe wrote it by himself. But if I say, but Yehoshua wrote it based upon what God said, that is not necessarily a question of heresy. Why? And I'm going to say it again. Because he believes in Torah min hashamayim. So now these terms are clear. On the other hand, this verse is very interesting. And now let's read Rashi. Source number two. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe la'achar matan Torah. Now what does matan Torah mean as far as Rashi is concerned? He means the Aseret HaDibrot. So after the Aseret HaDibrot, Alei Alei Ahara, after he already had said them all, come up to the mountain, Ve'yesha, and be there, for what? Arba'im Yom. So now you're going to come up for 40 days. Et Luchot HaEven, Ba'Torah, Ba'Mitzvah, Asher Katafti Lotan, what does Rashi understand this means? Kol Sheish Me'ot V'Shlosh Esrei Mitzvot, Bichlal Aseret HaDibrotein. All 613 commandments are included somehow within the Aseret HaDibrot. Rabbeinu Saadia, that's Rav Saadia Gaon, Piresh ba'azharot sheyasad l'chol dibur v'dibur mitzvot hatliot po. And Rav Saadia Gaon, among others, I'll add parenthetically, have shown how all 613 commandments can be subsumed within the Ten Commandments. Now, by the way, this itself is an interesting observation, because what is it that Rashi is telling us? Something which sometimes we get confused. What exactly is the correlation or the relationship between the Ten Commandments on the one hand and all 613 commandments? Again, are these the most important commandments? That was something which the Rambam felt very, very uncomfortable with, to the extent that the Rambam would have told you not to stand up yesterday for the Aseret HaDibrot, because if you do stand up, you're showing that it has a little bit more importance than the others do. I think the Rambam's position today is not necessary, because people don't really think the Ten Commandments are more important, and I can even prove it. Go ask any religious Jews if they can name for you all Ten Commandments. I won't put any of you on the spot. If they thought they were more important, then at least they would know them. But you know, this is clearly not the case. Anyway. And I think the way to solve the Rambam's problem is to stand up for the whole Aliyah and not just for the... Right? I saw somebody post that the Rabbi in the Shul... This is very cynical. Rabbi in the Shul said before the Aseret HaDibrot, make sure you speak now like you do during all the other Aliyah, because we want to be careful to follow the Rambam that you don't treat it special. Anyway. Last week when I had an Aliyah, and the Gabbai wanted to say the Kol HaMitpalalim, so I said, no, don't say that. I said, because some people are talking, I say Kol Kal HaKadosh, and he just started laughing. He couldn't contain his composure, because I said, if you say Kol HaMitpalalim, you're not including everybody who's in shul. You have to say, account for the other people as well. Anyway, so what did Rashi just now tell us? Or let's say the other way around, right, to borrow the term, what's bothering Rashi? What's bothering Rashi is the relationship between the Luchot HaEv and the Torah of HaMitzvah Sher Katavti, which means, or what's bothering Rashi is really something else. When Moshe comes down, and I'm skipping now to Perek Lamed Bet, so based upon what he's invited to come up with, what's he going to come down with? Yes? So the very end of Perek Lamed Aleph Yud Chet, it says, Vayitain El Moshe kichalato l'daberito, when he finished speaking to him, Bahar Sinai, Shnei Luchot Ha'idut, the two tablets of testimony, Luchot Evan, tablets of stone, Tuvim Be'etz Be'elokim, written with the hand or the finger of God. Which means, what does Moshe actually come down with? He only comes down with the Luchot, and therefore with the Aseret HaDibrot. And then I read this pasuk again, in business, this would be known as a bait and switch. Right? Advertisement is, you're going to get this and this and this. And what does Moshe actually come down with? He only comes down with Luchot. So what happened to the Torah? What happened to the mitzvah? What happened to whatever? What is Asher Katafti modifying? What does that apply to? So therefore, what is Rashi really answering over here? Rashi's trying to explain, what did this pasuk mean? So what's his explanation? Is that everything is in there? And what does Moshe really receive listen, the easiest way for us to say it is to say Torah Shebaal Peh. That's the easiest way for us to say it, is that Moshe receives the Torah Shebaal Peh as well. Now, if you ever wondered, hold it, where do we see that Moshe received the Torah Shebaal Peh? This verse is very, very challenging. Because if all that it meant, that God, again, follow Rashi, God already said, and by the way, this is Rashi or the Ramban, God already said the Ten Commandments. He already said the Aseret HaDibrot. They already know that. So now he's going to put it on stone. Okay, so what would our response be to that? I know it's not going to be your response. It'll be my response. So what? You already said it. I already know what it says. I already know the content. Moreover, why does it take 40 days and 40 nights? I know you can't get good help these days. But God does this himself. God is doing it himself. Why does it take 40 days and 40 nights to teach Moshe that which we already learned? He already heard God say it. We already heard the Ten Commandments. There already was Mamre Har Sinai. So again, what are we forced to say based upon the whole situation? No, there must be more content. That's what we're forced to say. So now, how did Rashi therefore understand the more content? What did he just now tell us? He said that the Moshe really received not 10 commandments, all 613 commandments. But how could I invite you for 10 commandments and give you 613? Now, I deal with other words there. HaTorah, VaHaMitzvah. But what's the correlation? So Rashi just filled in the correlation. What is it? So he's claiming then that the 10 commandments are not commandments. But what are they? They're categories. By the way, if you think about it, probably the best comparison of the Ten Commandments would be with the seven Noahide laws, the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. There's a very, very high correlation between the two of them. And just like the Ten Commandments are not specific commandments, because again, you get to stealing, right? Lo Tignov. How many different types of stealing have Jews come across, right? I mean, there are dozens of different types of stealing, so the same thing that, oh, don't steal, don't steal, there's many types, which means these are chapter headings, these are not specific laws. So that's really what Rashi is telling us over here. Ten Commandments were chapter headings, and now, the second challenge for you, which is again, very easy homework, but just a little time consuming, go through Parashat Mishpatim, and then take each verse and connect it to each one of the Ten Commandments, and you'll see how easy this is. And therefore, you'll begin to get the suspicion that that's exactly what Parashat Mishpatim is. It's an expansion of the Ten Commandments. By the way, the other place to do this would probably be in Parashat Kedoshim. You can also do something very similar there as well. And then you can, if you really want to, then you can compare how it's in Parashat Kedoshim and how it is in Parashat Mishpatim. Okay. Now, if Rashi sounded very expansive, there was actually other positions that he could have taken, which were broader. I'll start with the Gemara and then move over to the Midrash. What I'll stress the Gemara I'm quoting is the Bavli, because the Midrash we'll quote right afterwards is also found in the Yerushalmi. But let's read the Bavli in source 3. The Amar of Levi Bar Chama Amar Eish Lakish. My Dichtiv, what does the verse say when it says, V'nelechat luchot ha'evin v'atarah v'mitzvah asher katafti la'aretam, luchot elu aseret ha'dibrot. The luchot of the Ten Commandments. V'hatarah zo mikra. What's mikra mean? Scripture. Torah shebichtav. V'hamitzvah zu mishnah. Asher katafti elu neviim v'ktuvim. Lohorotam zo gemara milamei chakul minu l'moshe misinai. So this is what we can call a maximalistic approach to what was the content of Torah taught to Moshe at Sinai, that by the time Moshe finished 40 days later, not only did he finish all of Chumash, but he also made a siyum on Mishnah and a siyum on the Gemara. If that's not enough for you, then source number 4, Katav Lachat Devrim Eile, and we'll skip to its underline, B'shashen Niglea HaKadosh Baruch Hu B'Sinai Litein Torah L'Yisrael, Amra L'Moshe, Al Seder Mikra U'Mishnah Talmud V'Agada Shenemer Dvei Elokim Et Kol Devrim Eile. Afilu Masha HaTalmid Shoel L'Rav Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Moshe Ba'oto Sha'a. The Yerushalmi is slightly different there. It's Afilu Masha Talmud Vatik Hora B'fnei Rabo. Even what a Talmud will rule in front of his teacher. Over here, it's even what a student asks, which means if any of you actually our students and ask a question today, you can say, this was said at Sinai. Then the question, if it was said at Sinai retroactively, if it was said at Sinai at that moment. And this seems to be saying it was said at that particular moment. And I think that you all understand why I would call this a maximalistic perspective, because this is actually going far further. This is saying that not only did Moshe receive the Mishnah, the Gemara, and the Tanakh, and so on, but he actually received all the Rishonim and all the Achronim, and onwards, and so on. All of Torah received by Moshe. Now, of course, the only question is, and maybe this is not a nice question, but the only question is, how literally are we meant to take this? So then it depends on who you are. If you were Hasidim, then I would tell you that you absolutely should be taking it literally, because many of them do. And as a straight off, there's no question about this. Yes, Moshe received everything. If you're modern Orthodox, then of course you don't take this literally. So therefore, depending on how you take this, we'll tell you who you are. So just in case you're having an existential question, this is the way to figure it out. By the way, the Rambam did not seem... Excuse me? We'll get to him. You already want to get to the end? You ready? There's lots of middle grounds. There's lots of middle grounds. Two different students of the Maharal, whether he actually taught it this or not, I can't tell you, but two different students of the Maharal said there's a distinction between what Moshe knows and receives intellectually versus what Moshe sees prophetically. And those are not necessarily the same. Because, okay, I'll leave it at that. But of course there's middle ground. The Rambam seems to say that this is not a question of a literal interpretation as much as this is a question of authority. And maybe I need to explain this a little bit, even though that's not at all my interest today. Let me just point out, there's another midrash, and maybe that will help us a little bit, and I hope that I brought it for you. Source 19. Vayitein el Moshe. Now, this midrash is working off of the pasuk we just now read inside at the end of Perek Lamed Aleph. It said, Vayitein el Moshe kichalato ledaber ito. What does the word kichalato mean? Vayichulu hashamayim va'aretz. What does the word kichalato mean? Completed. So v'yitain el Moshe kichalato, that's the next word which the Midrash skipped. Amar avavahu kol arbim yom shasa Moshe lamala hayalom lamad Torah v'shocheach. So any of you who forget everything you learned, don't feel bad. Moshe had a better teacher than you do, and he keeps forgetting. Amar le rabona olam yeshli arbim yom v'en yodea davar ma'as HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And this is a theme that you'll find in a couple of places, the idea that Torah is a matana. God gave it to him as a present, which makes it sound like it's not subject to regular intellectual processes, but it's a present from God. And now the Midrash asks a question that maybe we would ask, but we'd be afraid to. It says, V'chi kol ha-Torah lamad Moshe? Did Moshe really learn the entire Torah? Ketuv b'Torah. And you have to enjoy the inside joke of this verse over here. Why? Ketuv b'Torah, and where is it quoting from? Iov. What do the other sources say? That he got everything including Nevi'im Ketuvim. That's part of Torah. Ketuv b'Torah, arucha mi'eretz midah, v'rachava mi'neyam. It's longer, it's higher than the earth, and it's wider than the sea. Ula arba'im yom lamda. Did Moshe really learn all the Torah in 40 days? He learned principles, right? Klalim lamdu HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'Moshe Have, that's what it means, kichalato l'daberito. Not when he finished speaking to him, rather when he spoke to him with principles. Now you realize this midrash is going out of the way to, forgive me, misinterpret the word kichalato, because the word kichalato really meant when he finished. And it's claiming, no, this chalato here really means something else completely, and that is God only taught Moshe principles, he did not teach him details. And the Rambam will take this teaching and read it into the other teaching. Which means the Rambam will say, yes, Moshe got all the Torah, and all the Navi, and all the Mishnah, and all the Gemara, in principle. but not as a but not in a literal sense. What does that really mean? What it really means is that no Navi can ever get up, and this will be obvious to you. No Navi can get up and say something which would be against what God taught to Moshe. And no Tana can get up and say something against, and no Amorah can get up. And we essentially have no right to interpret things against what God said to Moshe. But it doesn't mean in the literal sense that God taught Moshe every single thing, but it means that he taught him in principles. Now, that, as I said, that is one approach. Whether this is the approach that Rashi takes, Rashi much more sound to know. He taught him all Taryag Mitzvot already at this point. And now let's go back towards the beginning, because I want to juxtapose this with another Rashi. In source number 5, and this goes back to the introduction and then the Aseret HaDibrot, Vayidaber Elokim at kol dvarim ha'elu le'mor, and God said all of these things saying. Now, do you all realize there are too many words in that verse? What should have it said? Vayidaber Elokim, Anochi Hashem Elokecha. Oh, by the way, had it not even said Vayidaber Elokim, rather had it just started and said Anochi Hashem Elokecha, that we would have figured it out. So over here, again, in this pasuk, there are too many words. Vayidaber Elokim et kol hadvarim ha'ele lemor. Rav Salvechik, by the way, did give a 2-hour shiur, which you could find online, explaining the Rashis in this pasuk. We're going to look at one little element of Rashi. At kol dvarim ha'ele, milamed in source number 6, shomar kadosh baruch hu, aseret hadibrot b'dibor echad. He said all 10 commandments in one utterance, in one dibor, in one word, as it were, but it really means in one statement or one sound, which, by the way, we don't understand. Why don't we understand it? That's the continuation of Rashi. Mashi'ef shel adam lamar kinyan. A person can never communicate this way. So let me just pause for a second. What is Rashi teaching us over here? There are two possible elements to the revelation that took place at Sinai. One element is the content. What is it that God said? The other element is the fact that God spoke, which is more important. Which is more important? Which is more important? No. How do you know? Of course, that's what Rashi is saying. Rashi is saying that God speaks in a way that nobody can ever speak, in order that the people that are there hear something that nobody else can ever hear, which means that this is not good communication practices. When you want to communicate, we want to speak clearly. We want to put our words in sentences or paragraphs that could be well understood. What did Rashi just now say? God said all of these things. How did he understand that he said all of these things? So what did Rashi say? He said all Aseret HaDibrot in one word. By the way, we can now do what we can call the associative principle of mitzvot. If all 10 are actually 613 that we just now learned in the other Rashi, so what is it that God said just now in one word? He said all 10 commandments, which are really all 613 commandments, which means what did he say at one time? He said all of Judaism in one sentence. What do the people understand? Absolutely nothing. They understood absolutely nothing. We'll see this in the Psukim as we move on. But now go back. So what's the purpose of this? If they understood nothing, what's the purpose? What did they know? They had no idea what God said. But what did they know? That God just now spoke to them. And I'll ask again. So what's more important? Is more important the exact message? Oh, meaning if we had 10 commandments but there's no God, how important is that? Or there's a God but we don't know the 10 commandments. Which way is more important? So what is Rashi saying here? There's no question what's more important. And what's that? The very fact that God spoke to us at Har Sinai is the important element over here. That's what Rashi just now said. Now let's read the Rashi again. Et kol dvarim ha'ele melamed sha'amar kadosh baruch hu aseret hadibrot b'dibor echad ma she'i efshar la'adam lomar kein, which no person ever could have said. Im kein ma talmud lomar od anochi v'lo yelecha. So what does it mean afterwards when it says anochi v'lo yelecha, which, by the way, parenthetically according to Rashi, was the only two commandments that God said to the people, but we have to qualify that in a second. That God then came back and started explaining the mitzvot. But that means, according to Rashi, there's 2 points. There's a two-stage revelation. First stage, God says all 10 now equals all 613 mitzvot. What do the people hear? Absolutely nothing. What does God then do? He starts to explain them, and what do the people do? Right. Look at source number 7. Umay dibor echad hein, b'dibor echad nemru. Kidetanya zachor v'shamur b'dibor echad nemru. Masha'in yachol hapel ledaber, masha'in ha'ozin yachol l'shmoa. So this Gemara, what did it just now do? And by the way, in the Gemara, it's always zachor v'shamur v'not shamur v'zachor. Why in l'chadod is it shamur v'zachor? Because his name was Shlomo, and he had to get it in the acrostic. And if his name was Zalman, then it would have been the way that the Gemara is zachor v'shamur b'dibor echad. So over here, we have the same idea, but in a more limited sense, that God said the two different dibrot, the one that we find in Yitro and the one that we find in Vetchanan, he said them both at the same time. So we have that same concept over here. In the Mechilta, we find, answering your question, source number 8, it called from Elam Elamich Amar Eseret Europa Dibor Echad. So, as I said, the Shomer V'Zochah B'Dibor Echad we're more familiar with, but the Mechilta is where Rashi got it from. It's word for word. And that's the concept. Okay. Source number 9 is immediately after God completes saying all 10 commandments according to Rashi at once. What I do want to point out, at least according to Rashi, is that there's 2 elements to the revelation. One element is, again, I think we understand this already, but I just want to explain it a little bit more. There's 2 elements to the revelation. One element is the very fact that God is speaking, and that the content is completely not understood by us, but I want to correct myself. It's that we don't understand the content, but we see this big, big, big picture of what Judaism is. Then the details will come up, and we'll see the verses in a second, to explain detail by detail. Now, even today, you have some Jews who love the big detail, the big picture of Judaism, but don't connect to the details. And then you have some Jews who love the details, but often lose sight of the big picture. And that is exactly what God seems to be doing at Sinai by giving us both, by saying, yes, we have a big picture, but there's also details, which what the big picture is made of. But as I said, there seems to be, again, that's exactly what Rashi is telling us, there's this two-tiered revelation that takes place, and we're only willing to accept the big picture. We're not willing to accept the details. So again, now you can fill in the blanks and say if all the Jews at Sinai were conservative Jews, reformed Jews, secular Jews. You can, again, whoever you want to attack, but the truth is we should be attacking ourselves. So that's why the Naseh v'Nishma becomes so interesting. But according to Rashi, Naseh v'Nishma is before they heard anything. Before they heard anything. Naseh v'Nishma was totally, totally leap of faith. Again, according to Rashi, because he brought it back before they even heard the 10, the picture, or anything. Okay. Now we can understand the dialogue that takes place immediately afterwards. And that's source number 9. And by the way, part of what I want to stress along the way today is that everything that I've been pointing out, yes, there's been Gemarot and Midrashim and Rashi and so on, but everything I've been pointing out is based upon interesting nuances in the text itself. Right? In Perikuf Dalet, come up, I'm going to give you the Luchot Evan and the Torah and the Mitzvah, Shekotav Tilotam. That's very interesting, considering that he only gets the Sereta Dibrot. Over here, Medeber Elokim et Kol Avrim Eilaleimor, that's a very difficult verse. What's, again, too many words over here. So everything that I'm really trying to get to today is to explain what all these extra words are about. Now, source number 9. Source number 9 has another textual nuance, which is very difficult. V'chol ha'am, and all the people, translate, help me now, ro'im means see, et ha'kolot, what do they see? They see the sounds. Now right there you realize that there's something going on. Again, those of you old enough who experienced the 60s properly, so then that should not be a question. But ro'im et ha'kolot is something which is really quite strange. What else do they see? Ve'lapidim. Okay, that makes sense. What's lapidim? Ve'et kol ha-shofar, meaning we're still going off of Ro'im. They see the kol ha-shofar. Ve'et ha-har ashen, and the mountain's full of smoke. Vayar ha'am vayanu v'imdum rechok. The people see this, they get frightened, and they move away. Vayomu el Moshe daber ata imanu v'nishma'a. When you speak, then maybe we'll be able to hear something. We're not hearing anything. Which means the verses immediately following the Seret HaDibrot point at some type of a total, not just that we are spiritually freaked out, but it also is pointing to some type of a lack of communication, because God speaking is just not the same way as man speaking. And when God speaks, people see and people don't hear, and the senses are flowing from one to the other, which, by the way, I'll add in one little word which will make the whole thing make a lot more sense. Doesn't this sound remarkably like prophecy? That all the people see, because they're all having a prophetic experience, so all the people see the sound. This is not the normal experience, which means all the people just now had an experience. Now, what would Rashi have lead us to believe? And again, I'm not saying that in any kind of negative way. What did Rashi say they saw? They saw all 10 commandments at once, which were really all 613 commandments at once, which they see the entire Torah. And this is totally overwhelming to them. And then they say to Moshe, if you speak, then we have a chance of possibly understanding. Va'al yidaber imanu lokim pen namut. And if God speaks to us, we will die. Va'yom Moshe la'am al tirau, don't be afraid. Ki la'avur nasot etche ba'alokim. God wants to uplift you. U'bavur tiyeh yirato p'neichem levilti techtau. And to have the fear of God upon you that you're not going to sin. And I'll now read into this. If God teaches you all the details directly from God, that becomes a game changer. If we learn the details from our parents and from our teachers and from our rabbis, from other peoples, it's not the same thing as hearing it directly from God. Of course, what's going to happen? They're not going to take it directly from God, which therefore will mean that they will sin. By the way, which sin will they end up doing? Right? What were the two commandments even? What were the two commandments? I am God, took out of Egypt. They don't make a graven image. So what do they then do? They'll make a graven image and say, and you took us out of Egypt. Which means we realize now that something here is going terribly, terribly wrong. But right, this is the moment. This is the opportunity. God is speaking to us. God wants to give us the entire Torah directly. And we are unwilling to accept the entire Torah directly from God. Rather, Pasuk Yud Chet, Vayamod Ha'am Meirachok, and the people all seem to move away, and they all back away. U'moshe Nigesh El Rafael, Asher Shem Lekim, but Moshe moves closer to where God is. Which means what we basically have is, everybody's there at Sinai, and they go in two different directions. Moshe goes to God, and the people move away. And that's basically the beginning of the tragedy, which we know of Jewish history. But it all starts right here, because it's supposed to be very, very different. So, I now want to point out that even according to Rashi, there's two different stages. What's the first stage? The first stage is God wants to teach the entire Torah to the entire people. How did he try to do this? By saying everything to us, and then he was going to break it down into pieces. What happens when we're unwilling to do it? Where did we start today? And God says to Moshe, come up to the mountain. When did Rashi say that happened? After the Seret HaDibrot. After the people moved away. After the people said, we can't take this. So now, what's plan B? Plan B is that Moshe is going to get it. So how is Moshe going to get it? Moshe is going to go up on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. God is going to teach Moshe. Which means what it is that God is going to teach Moshe is what he originally was going to teach the people. Okay, good? So and again, I want to stress, every single thing that I've said so far today is not some type of acrobatics or contortionism in terms of the verses. Every single thing that I've said today is actually what the verses are saying, and it's normative, read Rashi, commentaries simply trying to explain what these verses mean, because the terminology is not all that simple. Okay, let me ask you a question. This is just like one of these things that you know, it's in our head someplace, but I'm asking you anyway. When Moshe comes down from the mountain, Moshe glows. Yes? Is it yes or no? Is that in the Chumash or is that in the Chumash or is that a Midrash? Okay, Moshe has horns. Is that in the Chumash or is that in the Midrash? There's no horns. Okay. 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 Good. Rashi. So, we'll see the Rashi in a second. So, is that the first time he comes down, or is that the second time he comes down? And there's two ways to know the answer to this. You know, one is what makes more sense, and two is what it actually says. So, which one is it? So now you're all afraid. That's great. That's great. That's great. You're all afraid. Which one? He went up twice, at least, according to Rashi, even three times. Okay, good. So let's read the pasuk then. The first time Moshe comes down is source 12. 11 is the Ramban, where he gets into this whole thing. Is it the proper sequence or not the proper sequence? So that's 11. We can ignore that because I already told you about that. Source 12. Vayifin vayired Moshe min ahar, ushnei luchot ha'edut biyado, luchot k'tuvim v'shnei Evrehim mize umize him k'tuvim v'luchot maaseh Elokim hema v'mektav mektav Elohim hu charot al luchot. You realize there's like a little overemphasis over here? What's the emphasis about? Or should I? It's not just that, yeah, the luchot about how they are. Help me. The luchot how they are.
Chiseled.
No, not just chiseled. There's something here about the. That they are not pedestrian. They are not something human. They are not something which are normal. What are they? Let's read it again. Haluchot ma'asei Elokim hema. Va'michtav michtav Elokim hu charut al luchot. And we're sitting here saying, well actually we're sitting here ignoring what it says, which is a very good approach to exegesis. But just in case we wanted to pay attention to what the words actually say, there is an incredible emphasis here that there's something over here which is divine. There's actually a beautiful interpretation of the Meshech Chachma. It's not here, so nobody remembers it. So I'll tell you where it is and where the context that he says it is when Moshe hits the rock instead of speaking to the rock. Right? What just now happened when Moshe did that? Moshe gave the impression as if he's the one who is doing it, as if maybe Moshe himself has some type of divinity or excessive holiness to him. Now the Meshech Chachma also says, that's the reason that Moshe couldn't continue, is because Moshe looked too impressive, and he said as follows, that was the reason that Moshe broke the Luchot, because what did he say? He said, if these people are worshipping a golden calf, which they made, they're certainly going to end up worshipping the luchot, which are actually divine. And therefore, as soon as he sees them worshipping the golden calf, then he says, okay, they can't have this. This is too holy. And he takes it and throws it to the ground. Which is, if you really think about it, it's an unbelievable statement, which means that we as Jews can't have anything which is too holy because we will mistreat it. Which means we have the capacity to turn anything into idolatry, even the luchot. Right? How's that for a scary thought? And of course, we can turn Torah into idolatry, we can turn mitzvot into idolatry, we can turn chumrot into idolatry, we can turn anything into idolatry, because we are incredibly, incredibly capable in terms of idolatry. So, over here, when we read this verse, we realize that the luchot, which luchot, by the way? Perek Lamed Bet is the first luchot, that the first luchot had within them something which was a sparkle, if you will, of the divine, written by God, God's hand. And I just want to ask you what I think may be an incredibly intriguing question. And I know the way the Zohar answers this question, but I just want to throw it out anyway. If when God speaks, he does not speak like we speak. When God speaks, what is the necessary response on the human side? It's a prophetic response. That's the definition. God speaks and we hear. No, God speaks and we see. God speaks. It's prophecy. That's what it means, a communion with God, or when God communicates with us. On the other hand, when God writes, what's the response? So I'm just going to then say that when God God's writing is analogous to God's speaking, and when God speaks, it's not a normal speech. When God writes, it's not a normal writing. And what would be the biggest evidence for this? What these words actually say. And this, there's something divine, which means when Moshe comes back and is just going to take his hammer and chisel and then rewrite exactly what God wrote, will it end up being exactly what God wrote? Meaning, that's exactly the issue over here, and I don't know how much we've thought about this, but that's exactly what really emerges from this verse. On the other hand, we look in Perek Lamed Daled, when Moshe comes down the second time, Vayihi Sham Im Hashem Arbim Yom Arbim Laila Lechem Lo Achal Lo Mayim Lo Shata Vayichtov Al Luchot Divrei Habrit Eseret Hadvarim. Moshe now writes the 10 things on them. By the way, you notice 10 things. Vayihi Beredet Moshe Mehar Sinai Uluchot Ushnei Luchot Eidut Biyad Moshe Beredetom Meyahar Umosh Lo Yada. And Moshe didn't know that his face glowed when God spoke to him. So, of course, what's the problem? Why does this happen the second time? Why didn't it happen the first time? Now, of course, if you want to tell me it really happened the first time, I would say, okay, I'll accept it, even though I really don't accept it, because it would have said it the first time. It only says it when he comes down the second time. So the second time, something happens. Bayar Aharon v'chol b'nei Yisrael et Moshe v'hine karan or panav. What do those words actually mean, Karan or Panav? The Karan or Panav, that Moshe could have been... He was sunburned. No, Karan or Panav, that Moshe's skin had a lovely glow to it. He could have been in a commercial for Ivory Soap or something. What does Rashi say in Source 14? It's okay. This is the Rashi you can quote, but not yet. You have to wait a couple of weeks for this one. Karnayim. He goes, what does karnayim mean? Lashon ma'or kishu nokev zareach derech hanekiv nira kimin karnayim boltin. What did he just now say? What does that mean? Rays of light. Rays of light. So he says, v'chein kikaran or panav. And it means the same thing here. Rashi over here seems to be saying that what did Moshe look like? Like exactly, like the rays of sun coming off of him that would look like Moshe. It looked like Moshe had horns of light coming off of him. So if you again, you want the source for Michelangelo and Atora Minayan. So this Rashi is actually far closer to that perception or perspective than you ever would have. Imagine, because we always say, no, it doesn't mean he had horns. No, Rashi just now said, it looked like he had golden horns coming out, which of course is real interesting. I'll just throw one thought at you. And that means that Moshe looked far more like the golden calf than we ever would have imagined. But let's leave that completely, and let's come back to...
So his face was looking
kind of so okay, good. So what you just now did is exactly what I want you to do, and that is that you're discerning that there must be some level of transference taking place, and that some kind of transference which is taking place is between those first luchot, but not in the second luchot, but those first luchot and Moshe, and that's what we don't understand. But again, I want to stress one thing. By the way, you know what? Maybe I exaggerated in the beginning. I told you I was going to say what the Beit HaLevi says. I haven't said a word yet that the Beit HaLevi says, and all that I did is I prepared the psukim for you to understand the Beit HaLevi, but now you see that, again, this is like the fourth or fifth verse, which series of verses, which is not all that simple, that you have this divinity about the Luchot, which now disappears, but somehow gets transferred to Moshe. So what does all this mean? Take a look at source number 15. Rav Yehuda bar Nachman Amar, Kishe Moshe katav et Torah, Nishtayer bikulmus kima'a, that when Moshe wrote the Torah, there was some extra ink in his quill, vihiviru al rosho, and he sort of like absent-mindedly wiped it across his forehead, umisham nasela karnei hahod, and that's how Moshe started to glow. Now, is that completely bizarre? Where did the glow come from? Oh, it's hard to work with these kind of materials, and if you ever do any painting, you end up with paint all over you. That's what happened. Moshe was writing the Torah, and he ended up with ink on him. Right? Isn't that a very disappointing interpretation? There's a similar teaching in Surah 16, which we're going to skip. And I just want to look if there's anything else that we want to see first. No, let's read the Beit HaLevi now. Source number 20. Okay, the Beit HaLevi, his name was Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. He was the rabbi, he taught in the Volozhin Yeshiva. He later on becomes the rabbi of Brisk. His son is Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. Reb Yosef Dov Soloveitchik was a descendant of Reb Chaim Volozhin. He then marries, his son Reb Chaim marries the granddaughter of the Netziv, who is also married to a descendant of Reb Chaim Volozhin. So the Rav was a descendant on various sides. Let's read. B'yalkut Parsha Kitisa Ita, it says, V'zeloshon, O'mehechon Natal Moshe Karnei Yehod, V'yehud Bar Nachman Omar, Kishim Moshe Katav at the Torah, Nishtai B'kul Muskima V'yivir Arosho, U'misham Nase Lo Karnei Yehod. V'nei Divrei HaMidrash Halalu Muflaim Ma'od Satum V'chatum. You like the way that he just now described it? He goes, this is very wondrous what it says. It's Satum V'chatum. What does that mean? U'mi Ya'amod B'sodo. And who can possibly unravel its secret? And all that I want to do is to explain a little bit of what I think is going on. When God spoke to him, and what's implied from it, Nira, Karan or Panav. He says, what's pshat in the Torah? Moshe didn't know that his face glowed when God spoke to him. So how is the Midrash saying it's leftover ink in the quill when it says in the Chumash what happened when God spoke to him? Umovad lefi hanireh inu oto inyan shemirmaz lo midrash od zod yesh lavin mi pasuk atzmo deregam mikodem diber imo pa'amim harbei Yehud. Moreover, God had spoken to Moshe a number of times before this. Most notably would be the first time he went up. God spoke to him, exact same scenario. So why now does it say, second Luchot, now does it say that Moshe's face glowed? Next paragraph. Od ita b'yalkut, it also says the Yalkut, Parsha Kitisa. Al pasuk v'yikasher karav Moshe el ha-machaneh, nistakel Moshe b'luchot v'ra'ah. Another teaching. When Moshe gets close, what happens? He sees haktav shebahen pareach. He sees that the letters on the luchot start to go back up into heaven. Have you ever heard this teaching before? It's a beautiful midrash. Moshe's coming down to the camp. He sees they're worshiping the egel, and all the letters on the luchot go back into heaven. What? Okay, so I'm saying it's a beautiful midrash, and he says that's what happens. Shaben perech v'kavdo al yedei Moshe v'neflu miyado v'nishbaru. And what happened as a result of all the letters coming off, suddenly it got very, very heavy, and Moshe could no longer hold the luchot, and they fell out of his hands and they broke. What a strange midrash. Also goes completely against the text. The text says that Moshe takes, throws it to the ground. Apparently in a fit of anger, he throws it to the ground. And over here it says that no, something else happened. Now, this midrash that he's quoting for, if I actually will fill it out a little bit more, it says that when Moshe comes down from the mountain, Moshe's not holding the luchot. The luchot are carrying Moshe. Again, the exact opposite. Which means that you can imagine somebody coming down from heaven, bringing the luchot to the people. You want to understand it figuratively. It's like the luchot, are they heavy? Of course they're not heavy. But it's saying no. The midrash is saying it, again, as much as you want to take the midrash literally, it's saying the luchot are in a sense animated, and the luchot are carrying Moshe down. It's almost like a cartoon scene. The luchot are carrying Moshe until something happens, and all the letters go off the luchot, and at that point what happens, the luchot then become rocks. And the rocks become very heavy. And at that point, Moshe can no longer hold them. And at that point, they fall to the ground. Let's continue the midrash. V'yesh lahavin kavanato, ma zeh sheparach meim hakatav, v'gam yesh lahavin hakavana, ma da'amah denasu kvedim hayado. What in the world does it mean when the midrash says that the letters went away? What does it mean it got too heavy? Okay. Hinei b'midrash b'shash neglat kodesh baruch hu b'sina. Litein Torah amr Moshe ala seder mekra mishna v'tamud v'agada shenemer deber lukim et kol dvirma el lemor. Afilu ma shetamud v'tik sho'el l'rav. Right? That's the way the Yerushalmi has it. Omer le Moshe echtav otan lehem b'chtav. Omer le lo b'bnei shegalui lefanai she'atidim umat ha'olam l'shlot bahem v'litol otam mehem. Okay. I have to pause a second and explain to you what it is that we just now read. the first luchot are broken. What did God tell Moshe to write in the second luchot? Write hadvarim ashayu haluchot arishonim asher shibarta. I want you to write down what was on the first luchot that you broke. Okay, now the Beit HaLevi is going to tell us something. That means what was still on them when they broke. Which means... Exactly. What the Beit HaLevi is about to tell us is, he'll quote this, I looked it up this morning, it's a Zohar which is in Zohar Chadash in Rut, and it's also Zohar in Parshat Ki Tetzé. It says pretty clearly that in the first Luchot, when God says, come to the mountain and be there, I'm going to give you the Luchot Evan, Batorah, Mitzvah, Asher Katafti, according to the Zohar, goes on all of those things. On what? On the Luchot Evan, Vahatorah, right, Vahamitzvah, Asher Katafti. The Zohar says that all of Torah was on those first Luchot. You know, in our generation, it's very easy to understand that God gave him two CD-ROMs or he gave him two chips or whatever it was. The Zohar is saying that the first Luchot were different from the second Luchot. The second Luchot only had a Aseret Dibrot on them, but the first Luchot had HaTorah, VaMitzvah, Torah Shebichtav, Torah Shebapeh, the Mishnah. Everything was on those first Luchot. But what happened? The first Luchot... The letters went off. Which letters went off? The magical letters. Which were the magical letters? The magical letters was the rest of Torah, and what remained on them only Aseret HaDibrot. Let's read a little bit more to see how the Beit HaLevi explains this. Although I will tell you, because he says one more thing. Had there never been a Chet HaEgel, here, take a look at source 18. V'omer Rebbe El Azar, my dichtiv charot al luchot. What does it mean to get engraved on the luchot? Which luchot were those? The first luchot. Imale lo nishtabru luchot harishonot. Had those first luchot never been broken, lo nishkachat Torah mi Israel, the Torah never would have been forgotten. Rav Acha bar Yaakov Amar in kol uma v'loshon shalatet b'hem. The Jews never would have been captured by any other country. Shenemer charot al tikri charot el chirut. That those first luchot had so much on them, they had a power, the Jews never would have been captured. Now some of us, we hear this, we say, oh, you're talking about Nevi'im Rishonim, and the luchot are captured, not captured, and they couldn't have been... He's going much further than that. He's saying is that it would have been impossible for the Jews ever to have lost. When I say lost anything. Let me flip this around and say it the other way. What is the Beit HaLevi telling us? Oh, but this is the Gemara already. What is he quoting this Gemara is telling us? That when we sin... And at Har Sinai, we build an egel, we're guilty of Avodah Zarah, we kill Chor, we're guilty of Shvichot Amim, Komo Litzachek, they're guilty of Gilui Arayot, they're guilty of every single imaginal sin right there at the foot of Har Sinai. It means that in the future, there is going to be Jews guilty of Gilui Arayot and Shvichot Amim, Avodah Zarah, we will be guilty of every sin, and it means the first Beit HaMikdash will be destroyed. The fact that the Luchot, or the egel, was on Shivasa Batamuz, and the walls of Yerushalayim were breached on Shivasa Batamuz, is not just a coincidence, it's direct cause and effect. But it's the cause and effect in the opposite as well. Had there never been a Shvirat HaLuchot, had there never been... And now imagine again, what's Shvirat HaLuchot? When the stones lose their holiness, the walls of Jerusalem, the walls of the Beit HaMikdash never would have lost their holiness, and they never could have been broken. What the Beit HaLevi is telling us, again, this is the Gemara, he's saying is that if we only had the first Luchot, there never would have been Galut. We would have gone to Eretz Yisrael. Moshe would have been a Shiach. Moshe would have built the Beit HaMikdash. There never would have been any 40 years in the desert. The whole thing changes. But once there is the Chet HaEgel, we need to wait. We need to build the Mishkan. We need to stay in the desert. We're going to end up being there for 40 years. Moshe's never going to make it. The first Beit HaMikdash is going to be destroyed. There will be a second Beit HaMikdash that will be destroyed. And now listen to this unbelievable insight that the Beit HaLevi has. And again, it's based upon Chazal. Because everything that he says is just putting, he's just putting things together. But let's see, where are we up to? Amr le Moshe, tovo tam lahem bichtav. Amr le lo mabnei shagalui lefanai shatidin umot alam leshlot bahem. God says, no, don't write everything on the luchot, because the Jews will be captured by the non-Jews. v'litol otam mehem, and they're going to take them away. Remember the Gemara said, had there only been a first lechol, that never could have happened. Ela hamikra anit notein bichtav, rather, I am going to only put certain things in writing, v'amishna, v'talmud, v'agada, anit notein lam ba'alpeh, those things are now going to become Torah Shvapeh. She'im yavo umot ha'olam, for if the non-Jews will come, v'yisht abdu mehem, ad kan lashon ha-midrash. Here's what he's saying. He's saying, is that what's the real difference between the Jews and non-Jews? He says, not Torah Shebichtav. You have lots of non-Jews around who have now taken scripture. They even call it the Old Testament. They say that the Bible belongs to them. He says, what's the difference in the Jews and the non-Jews? He says, the difference is Torah Shebal Peh. But he says, but that was only necessary to separate it and to turn it into Torah Shebal Peh when it became clear that the Jews would one day go into exile. If the Jews would never go into exile, then everything could have been Bichtav. Which means this is giving an unbelievable insight. Again, here he's quoting again from Midrash. Why do we need Torah Shebal Peh? Because one day we're going to exile. And how will we prove that we're the real Jews? Because we're the ones who know the secret code, as it were, the family's secret code, and not the stuff which is written down, because anybody can read what was written down. Anybody can access the written things, but it's the oral Torah which makes us, which keeps us as Jews. But he says that only became necessary. This is Yerushalmi, by the way, that he's quoting here. But that only became necessary once it became clear that we're going to go into Galut. So the second that we're going to go into Galut, what else becomes clear? So let me read a little bit more there. Because of this, because the people copied the written Torah, and then there would have been no difference in Jews and non-Jews. In order to keep the Jews separate is why we have Torah Shebal-Peh. Now we see in our eyes very clearly, the thing which distinguishes Jews and non-Jews is the Torah Shebal-Peh. He goes a little bit further, and it says in the Gemara in Gittin, meaning you only need a difference between Jews and non-Jews if Jews go into exile. As we said in the Midrash we saw. Because it was clear to God that at some point the non-Jews will, and I want you to appreciate this. Normally, what would happen in antiquity? You would have a nation, and they would be conquered. So what would happen more for the non-Jews? You would take them and disperse them, put them in different places, break them off, they would have no identity, take them out of their land, no connection to their land, they lose their identity, lose their national identity, and what would then happen? They would completely assimilate to within the place that they go. So what does the Gemara say what's going to happen? No, the opposite is going to happen. You realize, of course, what the biggest revenge we ever took on the non-Jews? We gave them the Torah Shebichtav, and we gave them guilt. That was the biggest revenge. You destroyed our temple? Great. We're going to convert you all to Christianity. Now you can walk out with guilt for the next 2,000 years. And they, by the way, they weren't happy with us about this. This is what it says here. But, there's still going to be a difference. And what's the difference going to be based on? On Torah Shebal Peh. That's only once we go into exile. And as we go into exile, now we need the differences. This is only possible by the second luchot. That once the first luchot were broken, now as we saw the Gemara said, the Gemara in Erevin, now it's decided they have to go into Galut. Im yichtu od yoter, avokodim shenishbru, before the first luchot were broken, harei ita b'mesechet Erevin, imala lo nishtabru luchot, had luchot not broken, in kolum avu l'shon shaletet bahem. Then nobody would have conquered them. Shenem ar charot luchot, cherut, and so on. She will skip a little bit. The first luchot were a divine miracle, but it only could be if we would have been on that kind of level to go straight from Har Sinai to Yerushalayim and build the Beit HaMikdash, as I'll say it again with Moshe as Mashiach. Haktav shebehen pareach v'kvodo yidei Moshe. And that's what it means that Moshe looks and the letters go off it. It gets very heavy. Pirish. Dahach shel Torah shehi ata ba'al peh shehi katuv behem parach me'aleim kevim demata yishtabdu mehem akum v'yif shar shuv liten lehem akol b'chtav v'nim tza'az lo nishtayer b'yad Moshe rakach shebichtav l'chudei v'lo hiya etzlo Torah shebaal peh klal ki parach v'halach lo. The reason it got so heavy is because now all that Moshe had was Torah Shebichtav, even in its pure sense, just the Sereta Dibrot, and didn't have the Torah Sheba'al Peh, because originally it was all written on the Luchot, and now it suddenly became very, very heavy, because it's unattainable. You cannot just have a Sereta Dibrot without the Torah Sheba'al Peh, without the rest of it, and that's what he's saying, is that the Midrash is trying to teach us symbolically. It got so heavy that Moshe couldn't possibly hold it. We'll skip a little bit again. I assume that wherever I put the underlines, it's what I'm supposed to read. V'yitein Hashem Elai et shnei luchot, v'aleim k'chol advrim asher diber itchem bahar, v'rei degam b'chtivatam shel luchot, amar k'chol advrim v'gam nitirbu b'chtivatam, v'gam b'shna v'tamud ba'agada. One second, Yerushalmi. Right, that's what we saw, the Yerushalmi. V'rak gabe luchot shneiot k'tiv b'parasha k'tisa, pasol lecha shnei luchot avanim k'rishonim, v'katavti al luchot et dvarim asher hayu al luchot harishonim asher shibarta. Write what was there when you broke it, not the letters that went up. Amar lo sheichzor v'yichtov lo oto advarim shehayu al luchot harishonot ba'et sheshibru. Derei Torah Sheba'al Peh lo shivreim klal. Why? Because it went back into heaven. V'lo haya leim be'et hashnira. Derei perchu lehem mikodem. Because they went back into heaven. V'chein amar chakach v'yichtov al luchot et divrei abrit eseret hadivrim. And that's why when Moshe writes it, it says he wrote the 10 things. When God is going to give it, what does it say? The luchot ha'evan and the mitzvah and the Torah, asherka, everything. When Moshe is going to write it, it only says eseret hadivrim. And now the last paragraph here. V'rak Moshe Rabbeinu hisig kol ma shenitein b'koach enoshi lasig b'Torah v'nimtza na'aseh gufo kadosh keguf shel Torah Sheba'al Peh u'kamo shebeluchot harishonot hayu k'tuvim kol haTorah Sheba'al Peh k'mo kin achar kach hayu k'tuvim b'rosho shel Moshe kol ma shenitan l'adam reshut lasig b'Torah Sheba'al Peh v'nimtza se'eshel Moshe Rabbeinu chazar hakol k'mo she'a mikodem ha'shvira rak nitosef lo yidei zeh od mala gdolo debitchilu k'tuvim b'aluchot. That what happened by the second time, that now Moshe had to learn all the Torah Sheba'al Peh, and now Moshe had become different, which means Moshe became the first Luchot. The first Luchot had all of this magic to it, all of this knowledge to it, all of this Torah to it, which now could no longer be contained. Now Moshe had to go up the second time and learn all the Torah Sheba'al Peh, and that's why he's claiming that that when God spoke to him, the Torah Sheba'al Peh spoke, Dibur, when God speaks to him, Moshe becomes transformed. Why the second time? Because it's not the same content as the first time. The first time, what was Moshe's job? He was the moving company. Took it from God, brought it down to earth. What happens halfway down? They're worshiping the eagle. That just sets a whole series of events in motion, that if they're worshiping the eagle, if they can sin at Har Sinai, they can sin in any place. If they're going to sin at Har Sinai, they're going to sin by the Beit HaMikdash. If they're going to sin by Har Sinai, they're going to go into exile. If they're going to go into exile, then they need to now separate Torah Shebichtav and Torah Sheba'al Peh, because otherwise they will completely lose their identity, because everybody will take the Torah Sheba'al Peh as well. They go into exile. As soon as they are building the ego, Moshe's coming down. Now the letters, the Torah Sheba'al Peh letters, go back into heaven. At that point, the luchot become very heavy. At that point, they become unattainable. At that point, they fall to the ground. But when they fall to the ground, they only have the Sereta Dibrot on them. Moshe goes up a second time, but what happens second time? Moshe is willing and ready to write every single thing which was on that first luchot, and that's the leftover ink in the quill. He's ready to write it, but God is basically not willing for him to write it. But that's what ends up becoming part of Moshe's personality. So the leftover ink in the quill becomes the metaphor for what was originally written and is no longer written. And that, the Beit HaLevi says now the second time, this becomes part of Moshe. Now when Moshe comes down the second time, Moshe is transformed, Moshe is different. Which means we didn't lose the Torah Sheba'al Peh. We just lost the Torah Sheba'al Peh from being Torah Shebichtav. And now it becomes Torah Sheba'al Peh, and now it becomes on Moshe. But of course now what happens? Not only Moshe. It's that whenever people learn Torah, they're able to access this Torah Shabbat Peh, which is the reason why every single one of you are glowing a little bit more than from when we started.